Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Welcome to the show, and welcome to the Nerd Party in general. What is the Nerd Party, you ask? Well, it's a whole series of podcasts where we talk about nerdy stuff, movies, TV, pretty much everything nerdy you could possibly think of. So definitely check it out, nerdparty.com. You can follow us at Join Nerd Party on Twitter and also like us on Facebook. And more importantly, that sounds so pretentious. Like, now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's get to the real point. We are going to be watching 2001, A Space Odyssey, which is great because it's the movie's 50th anniversary this year, and they just released a new 4K Blu-ray of the film, which I am so excited to watch. I'm even more excited to have an excuse to watch it because my wife, Sarah, is with me and she has never seen this movie.
Never seen it.
Well, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome back, as if this is a new thing for you. So what is it? Why have you never seen 2001?
I don't know. I was thinking about that today and I'm assuming, well, obviously it came out well before I was even born. So
right.
I missed the boat, clearly. Yeah, and you know, those
movies.
Yeah,
why didn't you see this in theaters, Sarah?
How dare I? No, those types of movies, even if they're classics, I feel like a parent or someone has to introduce them to you. And I guess no one really ever introduced this movie to me until now.
Yeah, no one in my family was particularly interested in showing me this movie. I didn't know this movie existed. I think my first exposure to 2001 was, I think I knew about it. I'd heard of it, but I didn't know much about it. But my first exposure was a friend of mine in high school told me about it. And this was right around the time I was getting into film and was starting to like consider it as like maybe a career option or something like that I wanted to pursue, like studying films and things like that. And my friend, he described it to me as the most boring film he'd ever seen in all his life.
Oh boy.
And he was so adamant about how boring this movie was that it basically turned me off of watching the movie. I remember he was like, I was watching it and I had a bottle of Coke with me, and not like cocaine, like Coca-Cola. And he was like, I the only way I could get through it was, I was like, if I drink this Coke, by the time I'm finished with this Coke, the movie will be that much closer to being over.
Oh.
So it was such an overtly negative like reaction to the movie.
Yeah, and that's extreme.
It's really
that's
extreme.
And
so I was like, oh, wow. Okay, so this is not a movie I need to rush out and see. So for the longest time, my whole thing with 2001 was, oh, it's that boring space movie. And I didn't know Stanley Kubrick. I hadn't seen any of his movies. I wasn't a big fan because I didn't know much about him. And it wasn't until I got to college, I don't remember what changed my mind or made me want to watch it. I think it was just being in that environment and being introduced to new films and wanting to dive into the history of film and watch all these masterful filmmakers. And I think by this point in time, I'd seen A Clockwork Orange. So I was kind of like, okay, Kubrick's nuts and he makes visually insane movies. And I think I rented it from the school library and I put it on, and I was completely captivated, like never once bored. I recognized, I was like, okay, yes, this is a slow movie. I guess I could understand how someone could call it boring, but I was so hypnotized by it because it is so visually stunning. It's essentially like a cinematic visual poem. It feels so much what movies are supposed to be. I mean, truthfully, I could say that about a lot of movies that are completely different in tone and content, but this felt like such a pure expression of the art form that I was just completely like, gah.
Did you call your friend and be like, what is wrong with
yeah.
you?
Yeah. I mean, I was like, I watched it. I think it's amazing. I was not bored.
Yeah.
It was like, it's not boring, but it definitely puts you in kind of a trance, I want to say. It was hypnotizing. Like I was watching it, and I don't like, do you know anything about this movie?
Well, kind of.
What do you know about it? Because I don't want to spoil. I want you to go in as fresh as possible.
So, okay. First of all, people are going to make fun of me because for a really long time, I thought this movie and another movie were the same movie.
Which movie?
Spaceballs. which I've never seen. But I thought this was...
Oh, you haven't seen Spaceballs either?
No.
I mean, this is pretty much the same movie.
But I literally thought this... Spaceballs
totally ripped off
2001 Spaceballs. I don't know. I thought it was the same film. I thought it was a space comedy.
Yes. 2001 A Space Comedy was Kubrick's original title.
I don't know. This is my brain. Okay. So there's that. And then when I realized what it was, what I kind of know about it is Kubrick obviously directed it. It's a very quiet movie, or there's not a lot of dialogue, I believe. I don't know if that's correct, but that's what I've heard. And it's boring. That's the other thing I've heard. And I think it follows people on a mission to Mars or Pluto, Saturn, some planet that's not Earth. Something like that. But I really don't know anything about it except that it was apparently... Oh, and it made a ton of money.
It didn't at first.
Oh. So when it has made a ton of money.
Well, it has since. So since its release. But when it was first released, it was like... It didn't do great. Barely made its money back. Like MGM, the studio that distributed it, they thought about pulling it from the theaters because they were like, this is a huge disaster. But theater chain managers, like the theater chains, were like, no, hold on. Like people, young kids especially, are coming to see this movie. They're coming out in droves.
Yeah.
And the reason they were coming out in droves is because there are certain psychedelic elements that the film is famous for near the conclusion.
Because they thought it was Spaceballs they were going to see.
They thought they were seeing Spaceballs, yes. They were like, this is the famous Mel Brooks comedy. We are absolutely on board for this. But no, they would go and they would just basically just like do acid.
Yeah.
And trip.
That's amazing.
Like, they would just like go up as close as they possibly could to the screen. And you'll know when you see it. Like oh, no wonder.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the movie ended up, like, they kept it going and going, and it became kind of a cult thing because people would go out, get high, and go see 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it became a big success.
That's
afterwards.
Fantastic.
So, which is great.
Thanks, drugs.
Drugs have given us some great stuff. It's given us some great music. To bring it all back, the reason I asked what you knew about it is because I didn't want to go into too much detail, but definitely during the first 25 minutes of the movie when I first watched it, I was like, okay, I see how someone could be like not at all into this, but I was so into, I was like, I don't know what it is, but I am so like into what's happening.
Do you think it's because just being an ex-film student, you appreciate technicality in film,
this was just when I was starting off.
Oh, okay.
As a film student, this is my
basically. Is there any hope for year. Me to I, enjoy this?
I
film?
Think there's plenty of hope. This is my sophomore year. Of college, but it was really my first year delving into film studies. I'd done a lot of gen eds my freshman year. So this was really like, okay, I'm jumping into it. So I think I was enthusiastic about watching it because I knew now I was studying Kubrick and I knew that he was a master and blah, blah, blah. But if I hadn't liked it, I mean, if it hadn't spoken to me personally, I wouldn't have been like, yes, I love this. It was not necessarily a movie that I was like, I'm excited to watch it. I was bracing myself for the worst because of the fact that my friend told me it was so boring. But I adored it. And I mean, as far as what you think about it, I don't know. I mean, what Kubrick have you seen? You've seen The Shining.
That might be it. I have not seen A Clockwork
Orange.
Oh,
you haven't?
No.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
No.
And I know you haven't seen Dr. Strangelove because we've been talking about doing that for an
what
episode.
What else has he done?
Full Metal Jacket.
Well, I've seen like half of that.
Okay.
On TV. So probably not the best way to see it.
And then Eyes Wide Shut.
I've seen that.
Yeah. Which I just saw, which is
so I guess,
crazy.
Is that the only, does he have more?
There's lots more.
But those are the main ones.
Yeah. Those are like his big ones, Dr. Strangelove and On. Those are kind of like from that point on.
So where is this movie?
Dr. Strangelove.
Okay.
And I think that was 63 maybe. And then this was 68.
Okay.
And after that was Clockwork Orange, which was 72, I believe.
Okay.
And then Shining in 80 and then after that.
So I basically saw his newer stuff.
Yeah, and he has a bunch. He has some older ones that I haven't seen. Barry Lyndon. There's Barry Lyndon. I forgot about that because I haven't seen that.
And I haven't seen that either.
But I think you'll like it. Shining has a lot of similar pacing to 2001.
I love Shining.
Yeah, 2001 is much slower. Like it is much. It's a hypnotic.
How long is this movie?
It's like 2.5 hours.
Okay.
So it's.
And you feel every minute of it.
Well, you know, it's funny that I feel like ever since Dr. Strangelove, just based on what I read, critics were always split on his movies. And 2001, I think, was the first time where people were like really split. Like nobody, like it was like Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars. Other people, there was one review that said, yeah, New York Times called it somewhere between hypnotic and immensely boring. So critics were super split. Now it's of course everyone's like it's a masterpiece. Yeah. So but it's funny. I was trying to figure out what it is about this movie, like what made me so prepared, like you're asking, like why was I ready for this and why was I so like ready to embrace it? There are two movies I think prepared me for this movie.
Can I guess?
Yes.
Seven Samurai?
No.
That was my only guess. Okay.
There are two
I was
movies.
Just thinking of the longest movie I could think of.
There are two movies specifically that I think got me ready for this movie.
Okay.
And the first one was Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh.
The original, the first Star Trek movie. It was directed by Robert Wise. It came out right after Star Wars, and one of the big things they wanted to do was differentiate themselves from Star Wars. They're like, it's not going to be a big, fast-paced action movie. We're going to, you know, Star Trek was more about ideas and things like that, and they went way overboard.
Yeah.
And they were like, we're going to just, we want to be 2001: A Space Odyssey. So Star Trek The Motion Picture is extreme. It's basically the Star Trek version of 2001. It's so boring, but I loved it as a kid. I don't know why, but I think that trained me because there are lots of sequences in that movie of just people staring at spaceships and like special effects. It's, you know, it's clearly ripping off 2001. But I think that prepared me. And then Alien, the first Alien.
Okay.
Because Alien is a very slow paced movie. But very methodical in its pacing. Very like the visuals are very well constructed. And Ridley Scott has a really... to me, 2001 is so well paced, even though it's slow, and it's because of the visuals. It's because Kubrick was a genius in the sound design and the music. It never, there's always something to engage you. So, but I think those two movies.
That's fascinating.
So, you know, thank you, Star Trek: The Motion Picture, for making me enjoy 2001: A Space Odyssey. But yeah, another interesting thing about this that I didn't know was so Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh yeah, so he wrote
the book. Okay. But they worked together in tandem, Kubrick and Clarke. They like got, because Kubrick wanted to make a science fiction movie, and he was like, "Who should I talk to?" And Clarke was, you know, he's a prolific author, he's famous. So they were going to do it together. Clarke was writing the book at the same time Kubrick was working on the screenplay, and they kind of affected each other. And of course, the book ended up being more explicit about like what's happening, like what certain things meant, what, like, you know, the movie is very cerebral and you don't understand what's going on, which I prefer. I like it when I don't know what's happening. I'd prefer to kind of like have it be open to interpretation. It's so weird and bizarre that I feel like an explanation kind of undermines the beauty of the movie. So I never really was all that interested, but it was fascinating to find out that they wrote it together. Although apparently Kubrick got so frustrated working with Clarke that he tried to replace him with other science fiction authors, but they were like, we can't, like, they're too loyal to each other. So they were like, we can't do it. But,
well, and I thought this was just an adaptation. I didn't realize they kind of happened at the same time. Yeah. That's so interesting.
The movie came
you
out
don't
first,
hear about
and
that.
I think the book came out a little bit
much.
After. So if you really desperately want to know what's going on in this movie, you can read the book. I want to read the book at some point, but I don't want to know really. I don't need to know what these things mean. I've never understood when people are like, I've got to understand it. I like reading interpretations of things, but I prefer to, the more unknowable it is, the more effective it is to me. So I prefer that.
And this is why we liked the Twin Peaks revival.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Many people didn't.
Exactly. Lots of people were like, I want to know what it means. Yeah. I'm like, I don't need to know what it means. If I'm engaged with what's happening, if it was boring, it would be one thing. Then I'd complain. But if I'm engaged with what's happening, I'm engaged by what I'm seeing, then I'm like, an explanation doesn't matter to me. This movie exists on a plane of like deeper meaning or whatever. And I'm like, I'm perfectly fine with it being there. Not everybody was, though, because not only you know, were critics split on it. Apparently, during its one of its first screenings, it might have been its premiere in New York, 250 people walked out on the movie.
Oh.
It's amazing. It's amazing what time
can... That's so sad.
We talk about it a lot, but yeah. It's amazing what time can do to a movie's very reputation.
True.
And
very true.
I think 2001, very quickly, people caught up to it. But a lot of Kubrick's movies, every single one was met with like controversy and people hated it and people loved it. And then it wasn't until retrospectively you could look back on it and say, oh, that was great. It's a masterpiece. Like The Shining.
Well, Stephen King's like, I hate it. And it's like,
well, Stephen King hated it. But like also like Kubrick was nominated for a Razzie for worst director for The Shining.
That's insane to me.
That is absolutely
such a
insane.
Perfect horror film.
It is.
It's
and now
perfect.
People, some people would say it's the best horror film, which it very well could be.
Yeah,
but it just it goes to show you. But how do you feel? Are you at all interested in watching this? Or are you excited?
I feel like I'm going to brew some coffee first, you know, make sure I'm alert and awake and ready. But yeah, I'm excited. I've been wanting to watch more of Kubrick's films. So this one is, good of one to start.
This is my favorite Kubrick film. Oh, it's a lot of people's favorite of Kubrick's.
No, I'm excited. I like a good space movie, I guess. But
You like a good space comedy.
I do.
You're gonna
space and balls is great.
Laughs.
I don't know what I was thinking. I really like for legit 10 years. I thought they were the same movie. I was like, oh,
I'm glad
funny.
We solved that before we went into it. Well, I should have just let you go and thinking it was space balls.
Well, no, I realized later that that was not true. But really, I thought this movie was Spaceballs, not Spaceballs was this movie. If that makes sense.
Okay. Now that we've established that, let's go watch 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Now that we've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey, now that Sarah has finally seen it, we can ask Sarah, what did she think about it?
You know that emoji on the iPhone with the brain exploding. This is how I feel right now. My brain is exploding. We're mid-explosion of my brain.
We're watching it. We're going to try to work through the brain explosion.
That is how I feel.
It's going to be therapy
right now
for your brain exploding.
Yeah.
So you liked it.
I loved it.
Wow.
Okay. I really, really loved it.
I had a feeling you would. This is not a movie.
You don't know me.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe not. But I expected you to at least admire it. Like, I didn't think we were going to go into this and you were going to be like, God, I hated that. I thought you might be bored. I thought you might be kind of like, it was interesting, but I didn't think you would dislike it. But I'm thrilled that you loved it.
I really loved it. And it was really interesting. And it was insane and weird.
And was it boring?
No. It was slow, but slow is different than boring. Like, slow is fine if you have an end goal and you might not be barreling towards it, but you can tell. I mean, this movie, even though it was long, everything was intentioned, I felt like, you know, and everything had a purpose. So I was not bored. I didn't really look at my phone, which is usually the
amazing.
first cue.
I was keeping an eye on you because the movie is so, it's so methodically placed and paced, but it's such a, I've seen it before. It's been years since, I can't remember the last time I saw it. I think I said in the pre-show it was college, which may be right. It may have been, I think it's been maybe 10 years since I last saw this, or a little under 10 years, but it was amazing to watch it again. And we have the 4K Blu-ray, and that was amazing. And seeing it with that level of detail and quality, there are special effects movies from this era and later eras where you can see the seams. I didn't really notice anything. There's some things, obviously, where it's a little bit more like, oh, yeah, I know how they did that, how they, you know, walk around the set, the rotating set and things like that. But like the model work and everything looks incredible.
It was stunning. I mean, you could watch this movie in 2018. And it could be made in 2018.
That was the most amazing
fantastic
thing. And I knew that in the back of my mind because I'd seen it a couple times. But watching it again now, it's just kind of like, this movie is so timeless. There's really nothing about it that feels dated. Maybe the transatlantic accents.
Oh yeah.
Just the way everybody talked back then. Yeah, yeah. It's maybe the only thing that dates this movie a little bit.
And it invented FaceTime. Hello.
Yeah, it basically invented Skype, FaceTime.
Skype and FaceTime.
He calls his daughter and
wishes her a happy birthday.
Yeah. Like I said, when I watched it, I went into it fully bracing myself to be bored. Like I was like, I'm gonna get through this. I'm just gonna watch it. I'm gonna power through it. And I never, like, I remember when it opens and it's like monkeys and I was like, oh God, what's happening?
Yeah.
I knew. I was like, okay, just get myself in this headspace. I'm sure this is going to be tough. But it was like, even that, like, it was it weird for you? Because you didn't know anything about this movie. Was it weird that it opens at the dawn of man?
Yeah, I was like, oh, we're going way back. Okay.
And you got very upset when the jaguar attacked a monkey. You're like, did they just kill that monkey?
I was really pissed.
And then I was like, Sarah, those are people in suits.
Yeah, I thought it was real monkeys. I was so confused. Yeah. No, they looked really good.
They look amazing.
They look amazing. And then I even was like, Sean, when did Planet of the Apes come out? Because I wanted to do a little like side-by-side comparison. But
I wonder if the makeup, I feel like maybe the makeup people may have contributed to this as well. But this is much more where Planet of the Apes is a little more, you know, exaggerated. It's more overtly science fiction. This is very clearly supposed to be real.
Yes.
So the details and the closeness they got to actual monkeys. Mm-hmm. I mean, you believe
it. I literally thought, I was like, did they get a jaguar to kill monkeys? I was so upset. Was
although,
10 minutes into
who knows
movie,
what
like,
happened
oh.
to that stuntman?
I mean, yeah, you're like, he sacrificed himself for this film.
I forgot about that. And I forgot about the eyes glowing.
Yeah.
The animal eyes glowing, mm-hmm. which is amazing. And something I think, I don't know if it was overtly, but in Blade Runner, all the replicants' eyes glow like that. You basically shine a light in a specific way so that when the eyeball hits it, it basically goes into the pupil and reflects that.
So you get that
it.
Glint
so get
of,
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I adored that, but it was amazing to kind of experience it with you and just the confusion of, especially I think the beginning, it's very, I just remember watching it and just being like, I don't know what's happening, but this is so fascinating. And it's because Kubrick's a genius. Mm-hmm. He was a genius and he understood film and he understood the way to tell visual stories. Like he knew, he just I didn't fully get it as a youngin, but like I knew, I understood. I was like, why am I watching this? But I also, like, it was very easy to tell, like, okay, there's these monkeys who are fighting these other monkeys, and one of them finds a weapon, and that's after it sees the monolith. But like the music and the visuals, and it's just so, it's very powerful.
Yes. I didn't really know what to expect because I think the first like 5 minutes of this movie is just a black screen with music.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, how long is this going to go?
Something movies, I don't know. I feel like that's something older movies used to do that doesn't happen as much anymore. But I know Star Trek the Motion Picture did do that.
Okay.
As if it wasn't ripping off 2001 enough. It was like, we're going to throw in a black screen with music as well.
Yeah, well, I did, just going into this blind, I had a moment because I think we were like 20 or so minutes and there had been no dialogue. I was like, oh God, is there dialogue in this film? Like, yeah. I didn't know. And we were with the monkeys. So I was like, I think they go to space at some point. But
yeah, the first, I think they've said the first 20 and last 20 minutes of this movie just has no dialogue.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
And you, about halfway through, you're like, I can't think of another movie I've seen with this little dialogue.
Yeah,
like maybe Dunkirk is the most recent movie, because you asked me, you're like, what's the last like quiet movie we saw?
Yeah.
And I mean, Quiet Place
was
an obvious answer. But Dunkirk too, and Dunkirk is a movie, I think it's my favorite Christopher Nolan movie, and I've said that a lot. And I find the irony is that when Nolan made Interstellar, he was very clearly trying to make his version of 2001 or an homage to 2001. But Dunkirk to me feels more in line with 2001 because it is such a cinematic experience, so reliant on the cinematic language and visuals and sound like 2001, that it ends up being closer to 2001 than Interstellar. Interstellar has kind of the visual elements of it's like it's space and astronauts and things like that, but Dunkirk has the cinematic qualities in terms of the technique and feels more like that. And that's one of the more recent examples I can think of that you could say doesn't rely so much on dialogue as it does the experience, the visual and sound experience of the movie itself. But that to me was, I think 2001 was maybe the first movie I'd seen that absorbed me in that way, where I was like, oh, this is, you can do this. I'm a very character driven kind of guy. I'm very character driven, but I love, like, my favorite movies tend to be more character driven. I'm always like, if I hate a movie, it's typically because the characters suck. Like, I can, like, I'm like, I'll forgive the technique. I get it. It's a special magical mixture of all these elements working together. But I think I've found that a lot of times, if the characters don't work for me, I don't like the movie. And 2001: A Space Odyssey, the characters work, but it's not character driven at all.
No, you don't really know much about any of these people.
No, and really, the
you don't need to.
Yeah, I mean, Howl is the closest thing I think we get to like a human character in this movie. I mean, we have Dave and Frank, and we have other these astronauts, but everything is very thoughtful. Everyone is very methodical in their dialogue and what they're talking about, and they're all scientists and, you know, very, very like wordy, like very scientific and very, you know, it's, but Hal ends up being, there's kind of a running joke in the movie that the robot, the artificial intelligence, ends up being the most human of all the characters in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a commentary, I think. Yeah. I think that was purposeful and intentional to say, like, we're losing ourselves to the machine in a way. But did you, one thing that this movie is one of the iconic moments in the movie is the monkey throws the bone in the air, mm-hmm. and then it jumps forward like 3 million years, and it match cuts to a spaceship that looks like the bone. Did you notice that?
I didn't.
Okay, so this is a very, like,
I did not at all.
Because it's people like herald this moment. I think it's, I mean, it's a great moment, but the way people like praise this moment is hilarious. I would love to talk to like a film scholar to really have
them
sit down and explain it to me. It's basically like, you can, I mean, it's one of the most famous, and people reference this moment. Like, oh my God, that match cut is so incredible. It's like the bone goes up in the air, it kind of hits an angle, and it cuts 3 million years into the future, and all of a sudden we're in outer space, and there's a ship that looks like that bone, and we kind of move past it, and that's when we go into that whole ballet with the spiraling space station.
Yes.
But I always found it funny. I was always like, yeah, that's a great moment, but the fact that people harp on it so much is, I'm like, what about it is so amazing? I understand,
I mean, it
it's amazing,
cool.
But to me, it's one of the like, oh yeah, that was cool, and there's so much more in this movie that I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, I don't
incredible.
Know if that's what I would focus on. Clearly I missed it, and I still have plenty of other things that I was like jaw dropped about. So
we have this, we go into this, like, it feels like maybe 15 minutes of just the spaceship docking, and then you have
the symphony, and
I love, I mean, it's incredible. That was another moment where I knew my friend who had been bored by the movie, I was like, yeah, I guess I can see nothing's really happening. But I was so, like, in awe of the majesty of the sequence. And then just the kind of the insanity of the hostess walking up the wall and the pin.
I had to think about that for a second. Like, what's happening?
Yeah, the pin floating, and, like, how did they do that? I still, like, I was amazed to find out they used a sheet of glass. They just got a giant sheet of glass, and they attached the pin to it, and they just spun the sheet of glass and kind of moved it around.
What?
And then she came and picked it off the... I
that's
didn't
nuts.
Know, like, it that seems so obvious now, but it's like, I had no idea. And it looks so amazing. It's so incredible how much of this is in camera.
Yeah.
And
these
how,
practical effects are nuts.
Yeah. You can throw a $300 million budget at the screen, but somehow it doesn't look as good as this movie.
Mm-mm.
And this is such a big argument as to why in camera is so, there's just a visceral reality to it. And this movie benefits so much from that, because you watch it and you're just so amazed by the stuff happening. And a lot of that has to do with Kubrick too, because he's so insane and so, he was so detail oriented and so such a perfectionist that he was probably like, we're going to do all these amazing things and we're going to make it work. Whereas now studios are like, we'll worry about that later. That was basically it. That was all he like was like, we're going to get this right. But I love that. And then I remember there was one moment where one of the ships is flying over the moon, and I you hadn't really expressed what you thought of the movie, but I remember you went, I can't remember what you said. I think you were just like, oh my God. Like yeah. you just reacted. And I was like, what? Yeah. And you went, it's just like beautiful.
Yeah.
And
no, like, I, this movie like commanded my attention. Yeah. Like every time I was like, I wonder where this was going. It would snap me back with like, just this like glorious shot of something so incredible. I felt like I was there. And then the use of color and the music, really, I thought was one of my favorite parts of this whole
film. Was there a musical moment that stood out to you?
I mean, the end. I don't want to jump right to the end. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the end and the beginning and the middle and all of it.
End
no,
the beginning when it comes to 2001?
I don't even know.
is the question on everybody's minds.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
You know what music cue I can't get enough of is the monolith theme.
Yeah.
Whenever they find the monolith and that terrifying like cacophony
I didn't like
voices.
I was like I felt terrified. I mean, I thought I was going at first of all, I thought it was Spaceballs, right? So we like, okay, we're not seeing a comedy. And I was like, well, this is like a solid drama. I did not know it was gonna be like horror mixed in.
Yeah. There are elements that are like terrifying. This is a G-rated film technically.
Yeah, that's wrong. Yeah. Because I was terrified during certain parts of this film.
Yeah.
But that was surprising to me for sure. Yeah. So I was like, oh my gosh,
what was the first moment that really creeped you out?
I think when
the moon, when they first, I remember you were like, this is disturbing. When they like this is the second part of the movie, the second kind of vignette where it's like, we're going to go look at this thing and the astronauts go up to the monolith.
Yeah.
It's the first time we've seen humans interact with it.
Yeah, that was unsettling. There were many moments in this film where I felt physically uncomfortable and like my anxiety was through the roof, which I have not experienced in some time. I couldn't even tell you the last time I saw a movie where I like felt like I was like crawling out of my skin, and this movie accomplished that. Like that scene for sure. The whole scene with Frank going out to the mm-hmm. whatever that was that he had to do the first repair. And you
I think
just,
it was Dave.
Oh, was it Dave?
Yeah.
Yep. And you just hear the
breathing.
He's only breathing. Like the whole thing is silent and you hear him breathing in and out. I wanted to vomit. I was so upset. I was like, I don't know. It just had this like completely visceral yeah. reaction.
Well,
I think you saw
funny.
Me. I was like cowering. I was like, I felt so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
In
and it's
that
funny
moment.
Because, again, this is the importance of sound.
Yeah.
That without the sound is just boring.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, it's the way Kubrick combines the two and manages to make it a fully cinematic experience that really engages you. And it's the breathing that makes it uncomfortable. Like you just hear this, which is apparently Ugh. Kubrick, but he's just.
That's him?
He did all the, I think he did all the
you can
breathing
stop.
In the scenes. Just like the whole,
oh
like,
my
and
gosh.
It's just so, what a simple technique, but it puts you right in there with them. There's no like fanciful sound effects, there's
no
music.
It's
just
like 5 minutes of deep breathing.
You really get the
and
meticulousness
he's in space
of it.
And it's terrifying.
And it ends up paying off again when Frank goes out.
Yes.
And it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hal attacks him and it's all silent. And you just all you can hear is the
and then you just see him careening off into space.
Yep.
And I had a moment where I was like, oh my God, did he do that? Like, because they don't exactly show the impact.
You see the
right?
the ship go towards him.
Uh-huh. And then you see him kind of spinning out of control and he's flailing. And then you see his body kind of go limp. And it's just this like gross amazing moment. Like I can't even describe it, but it was just fascinating. It was
right.
fascinating.
And so let's talk about the Jupiter mission, which is that section of the film.
Yes.
To me, what that section of the film reminds me of, because this is people who don't know 2001, what it's about, this is this that entire sequence is like, oh, that's 2001. That's it.
Interesting.
Like it or that's what, you know, Hal, Dave. That's what people talk about when you talk about 2001 is those
the filling
the
moments of the sandwich.
That scene.
Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of It's a Wonderful Life, almost identical film.
Yeah. I can see it.
But It's a Wonderful Life, which is a movie I've seen almost all the way through, but I don't think I've ever sat down and watched it from beginning to end.
Well, it's always on TV every season. So.
Yeah. But what's funny about It's a Wonderful Life is everyone talks about, you know, it's about how he doesn't exist and he wants his life back and he realizes what an impact he has. That I think makes up only like the last 40 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
And then like
right.
the first hour or so is him meeting his wife and his like, I
It showcases
nobody talks
his life.
About the. Everyone is like, "Oh yeah, that's the movie," but no one talks about it. It's only 40 minutes. I feel like it's the same thing with 2001, where it's like the house
storyline.
That's
what you remember.
And it's, but it's because that is the only real conflict in the movie, the only real forward driving plot
right.
in the movie. Because yeah. you could argue Dawn of Man, you know, it's about the monkeys, and then it gets the thing, and there's an arc to that. There's kind of, I guess, an arc. They have stories. It's not like they are completely plotless, but this is the only one that has a sense of urgency, like a sense yes. of like there's a conflict. Something is going wrong. There's something to fight against. And, you know, there's a fight for survival, which I think is why people think about it.
Yeah.
But I let's talk a little bit about Douglas Rain, the voice of Hal, because before, when we recorded the before part of this episode, he was still alive, and now
yeah.
we're back, and he passed away.
So sad.
But what an incredible performance.
Oh my gosh.
What an iconic performance.
Yeah. I mean, just completely believable.
Yes.
And fascinating. Like, what a good voice actor.
Tell me
so
about
good.
Your relationship with Hal, how it developed as you were watching.
So initially I was like, oh, this is interesting. I like his voice. Oh, he kind of has emotions like a person. And then, like, you know, my heart dropped into my stomach as you start to realize that he is the spawn of Satan.
Yeah, you were like, he's evil?
Yeah, I was just like, oh, this is cool. And it went from, oh, this is really neat, to like, oh, no, this is. And how freaking terrifying he was. Like, I mean, he's a robot. He's yeah. just in a computer, you know, like he can't physically reach out and touch you. But the things that they accomplished,
yeah,
like
just how
terrifying they made it.
The visual of the eye.
The red eye always watching. And like that moment where he's reading their lips when they're having the conversation. I think that's when I was like, oh my gosh.
You're like, wait, he's reading their lips?
I was like,
what?
No. Yeah, I was like very verbal about
that
this.
Yeah, that was great. There's an argument to be made that Hal is sympathetic.
Why?
What do you think about that? Well, let's explore this a little bit.
Right.
Hal only becomes sinister and becomes a problem because he finds out that his life is in danger. And
yeah.
in reality, he reacts no differently than Dave does. Dave kills him in self-defense. Mm. Hal only, he's having issues and he's starting to
crack.
But his killing them is motivated by their threatening to kill him first. So all his actions are, in a sense, self-preservation.
Yeah, but the three astronauts that are just in the pods.
He kills everybody. Because, I mean, how do yeah. you explain that? I think he's just like, I'm going to kill everyone. And
so,
his excuse, he's like, I won't let them endanger this mission. It's too important.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is that the excuse, or is it because his life is in danger?
I think both. I think that's maybe how he justifies it to himself. Or, and then there's the argument, does he really feel any of this? Like, when he's begging for his life, is he just imitating? Or is that a genuine soul that is begging for its life?
I'm fine with him killing him. I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's interesting because
you immediately
empathize with Hal.
I did not empathize with Hal.
I mean, you
Hal.
Were very upset.
That's
true.
I was really upset.
The reality is, I think it's funny that... You had a funny moment when he goes, he went, I'm afraid. And you went, no. And then
right.
you went, no, I hate you.
Oh,
kill
that's
him,
right.
It.
That's
You're
right.
You're like, don't listen to him.
I totally forgot.
So
I had an inner conflict.
That was, I forgot about when, I knew he sang Daisy, which was terrifying.
Oh yeah. As the voice starts getting lower.
I knew he was like, you know, the whole, my memory is going.
Yeah.
But the, I'm afraid, I forgot about that. And that like gave me a shiver. Like just hearing him say, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I can see that school of thought for sure.
Yeah.
But I still like, I'm glad he did.
You relate
he did.
I mean, but it's funny what we empathize with. We empathize
yeah.
with Dave. We don't know anything about Dave. We
it's
know
just
that
he's human.
He's a he draws sketches.
Yeah.
And we like him. Yeah, he's human.
He's human.
And he seems, you know, we had that little interview with him and
so
and
basically we side with our species.
We side with him because he's human yeah. and we can empathize with that. We understand.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting dilemma and people have talked about it. Who is more sympathetic, Hal or the humans? Because again, the argument is that the intelligence, the artificial intelligence, ends up being more human than the real people, who are almost just parts of the machine. Just like you said, you even said, he's like, oh, he's very calm. Like when he's going out to save Frank, he's just very, everything is kind of underplayed, which I think is actually brilliant. I think that's part of, I don't see it as like they're not emotional. I just see it as they're very,
well,
like,
they're clinical.
They're clinical and they're professional. They know what they're doing. Emotions. When he realizes like, oh, I'm trapped, I don't know what I'm going to do, he doesn't really react. But you see, it's in the performance too. I think so much of why we empathize with Dave is because of the performance of, I think it's Keir D'Elia. I don't know if I pronounced that right. But that is why I think you relate to it. Because he's a good-looking guy, and he's well-intentioned. Nobody has ill intentions. Hal's the only one who has really ill intentions, but I think it becomes something where you're just looking at this guy and you're like, I want him to win because he's a human and the robot's trying to kill him.
I mean, but just like unplugging him isn't really killing him, is it?
It is. He completely basically wiped out everything about him.
But was that what they were going to do? I thought it was just more of a like, let's just turn this off.
I think originally they were like, let's turn it off.
Yeah. Okay. So Hal kind of overreacted. First of all, he could have just gone into a nice little sleep.
I do think there it was an element of they were just going to shut him down. And maybe, self-preservation.
Yeah.
If he gets turned off, there's no reason to turn him back on.
Yeah.
And also, who knows what the process is.
Really knows what the mission was? Well, we learned a little more about it, obviously.
We learned later. Yeah. Although, apparently in the book, it explains the reason Hal malfunctions is because he was hiding the reason behind the Jupiter mission, like that video
that he sees.
So it's like, because he had to lie about that, that kind of created a conflict within him that then causes him to malfunction
That kind of would have been interesting if they explored that a little bit, but I don't, maybe they wouldn't have been able to show that.
Well, that's the other thing. And let's dive into the last part of the movie, which is just basically the acid trip that got this movie millions and millions of dollars because people would get high and watch it. The last 20-30 minutes of the movie is just Dave traveling through space, being led by the monolith.
Time and space. Felt like
transcending everything and ending up in this new
room.
Realm? Room? Yeah.
Welcome to your home. He basically
ends up on a Stanley Kubrick set. Let's talk a little bit about this.
I don't even know.
I said in the pre-show, apparently Arthur C. Clarke's book is more explicit and explains like, here's what it is. Here's what's happening. Here's why they end up here. Here's what the Star Child is and all that stuff. I am more on the side of Kubrick. I think there are things in life that are inherently unknowable.
Yes.
And the things that you could explain, you lose kind of the magic of it if you try to explain it or you try to make it concrete. It's something ethereal that you shouldn't make a reality. That's how I feel. I feel like the magic of the thing is I don't know. I don't fully understand because we can never fully understand anything. I feel like that's our natural state. We don't know what's out there. We don't know what's going on. To try to explain it is boring because the explanation is not as interesting as the mystery of it. It's like the traveling is more enjoyable than the destination, that kind of argument.
Yeah. And I think every individual that watches this is going to have their own reaction to it. Because it's that you're going to project
right
your feelings onto this movie and what it might mean to you or to the world.
So Sarah, what does it mean to you, the ending?
I'm not 100% sure, but I did get a lot of evolutionary vibes, birth, rebirth, evolution. I mean, just a small thing that kind of hit me is that during the Jupiter mission, they're all drinking their food from straws. And in the end, he's eating his food. And I know that's like a really simple thing, but like to me, that shows progress. Mm. And I think it was so trippy and weird.
At some point, and I even thought about doing it for this episode, but I've never looked up an explanation for the ending. I almost don't want to know explicitly what
it's about.
I'm
sure there's a great Reddit thread where people
I'm not actively trying to avoid it, and it's not going to ruin it, but I almost am like, experimenting with my with myself. Don't take that out of context. That sounds wrong. But I'm experimenting with just like, can I just live my life not knowing what this means? Yeah. I don't want to know what this means. If I were to guess, it's very interesting that he shows up. He's already an older man.
Yes.
Every time he sees the future version of himself, his past self disappears.
Dies or disappears. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's time. You know, we've said he's transcended time and space. So my thought is he's ended up in this strange new dimension that has been created for him by the monolith so they can experiment and learn about the species.
I definitely think he was being watched because he was being fed. And right, he obviously was contained in this big white room.
He was basically imprisoned.
Yeah.
But he had like his luxuries. He just didn't have contact with anyone.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because at the end, his last act is, we could talk a little bit about that, is his last act is reaching out maybe for companionship or understanding to the monolith, this god that has trapped him.
You saw that same exact thing where the monkey reached out to it when they closed. So
everyone,
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, everyone loves that monolith. They all want to reach out and touch it.
But he was like curious and afraid. Like you could see it in his voice, even as an old man on his deathbed. He's like... fascination.
It's interesting that he decides to carry out the mission even though everything went wrong. It's almost like he wants an answer and he never gets the answer. It's kind of a metaphor for humanity. We're always, the monolith is that unknowable, like what created us? What does it all mean? And at the end, it's like he reaches out, he wants the answer, like just give me something, and he never gets it. And instead he transforms and is reborn.
Or that is the answer, really. Maybe
again.
He does
get
the answer. Just
I always wondered, is it, so it's the Star Child, that's what they call it, and I've always wondered if it's an idea or if it's something, because the last shot is the Star Child kind of coming to Earth
and
looking,
and its little uterus,
its little
bubble.
Yeah. Kind of the creepiness of it staring at the planet, and that's the last shot of the movie. I never knew whether or not I'd fell on the side of this is happening. This thing is actually going to Earth and is going to be, it's going to help Earth like transcend or what, or if it was just like kind of a weird psychological metaphor for something.
I think it's real, or I view it as being real, because I think it was the final stage when you saw all four of the, what are they called again?
Monolith.
Yeah. I keep calling it the wrong thing.
The first thing she said was a basilisk.
Yep,
she's
that's
like, the
a
basilisk.
Snake.
Lots of basilisks in this movie.
But yeah, I saw it as kind of the final step in all four of those stages.
I saw it maybe as like the monolith. There's an idea that the monolith is like each time it's like an alien intelligence, clearly, that is there to provide the next step in human evolution, because every time you see it, you're leaping forward. The apes see it and they learn to kill.
Yeah.
And then death is always surrounding the monolith, actually. Every time you see the monolith, the death is involved somehow. We don't know what happens to the people on the moon, but something terrible happens to them.
Well, because they hear the high-pitched frequency, right?
And
they're
like
they're holding like their helmets.
Dying or whatever. Yeah. We don't know what happens. I assume they die.
Yeah.
Then the next time when Dave sees the monolith, he dies and he's reborn as the next thing. And maybe it's them trying to bridge the gap between whatever they are and humanity, the next step of evolution or whatever it is.
So where does Hal fit in?
I think Hal is just a metaphor of like how humanity is losing touch with its humanity.
Because like without Hal, would we still have ended up where we were?
Right. Hal, I think, is a commentary on can a machine be human? Can it have a soul? Can it really function as that? Is it like, what does it mean that the machine has more emotional responses than the humans do?
Yeah.
Like, are we getting to that point? And is the monolith trying to save us from that? Or is it trying to encourage that? I don't know. And frankly, I don't care. I like questioning it. And I don't know if...
I do too.
There's a sequel to this movie.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
By?
Not Kubrick.
Didn't think so.
No. I honestly can't remember. But I
is it 2002?
It's 2010.
Oh.
The year we make contact.
That's what it's called?
That's what it's called. And there's some distant relation. It's... I bought it, actually. I tried to watch it. I got about 30 minutes in and I was like, I can't do this. It was so like, no offense to whoever likes that movie, I've explained already, I don't want to know, I don't need an explanation, I don't care. 2010 is to me the person saying, no, you do want to know. And I'm like, I really don't, please don't show me this movie. That I tried to watch it and it was like, it has an actual plot, there are actual characters, and I'm like, I don't want this, I don't care. I got everything I need from that movie. And if you're literally making a movie to explain what happened in 2001, like the least appealing thing to me. So I've never seen it. I tried to watch it and was just kind of like bored by it.
Well, this film was like perfectly end capped. Even if it's, you know, loose ends, it's still like a full story that does not need to go any further, in my opinion.
No, I completely agree with you. I can't. I don't care. But which section of the movie did you like the most? I feel like maybe that's a stupid question, because I feel like the easiest section to like is the
Jupiter,
stuff, the Jupiter stuff. But was there?
The whole thing was, you can't have, like, there are three parts, right? You can't have one part.
Four parts, technically.
Four.
Dawn
of
Man,
that's right.
Dawn
that's
of
right.
Man, there's the actual, like,
right.
The moon, like, going to the moon. There's the Jupiter mission, and then there's Beyond the Infinite.
I don't know. I don't think you can have any of them without each other, and I just thought the whole thing was just such a beautiful story. The whole thing. So I don't know. I mean, obviously the most fascinating and the one that got the visceral reaction from me was all the HAL stuff and the Jupiter mission. But I honestly don't know if I could choose, because the music in the first part, or, you know, I guess the second part after the monkeys, like, that was fascinating to me and so beautiful and powerful, and all the visuals. I mean, I don't know if I could choose.
Yeah.
It's all great.
Yeah.
And then the trippy acid Windows 97 screensaver that you go through was super cool.
I still don't know. Like, I watched that, and again, that's like, I mean, there's a level of, but they didn't have computers back then. Like, how they created that and how they made that work is just like.
And his intercutting with his face.
Yeah.
Where you start to see, like,
his reaction,
there's, like,
to
pain
it.
And horror, and, like, then peace, then it, oh, I don't know. Just, it was just really good.
Yeah. So I guess, so you've only seen The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut. Where would you place this?
Ooh. Asking me the hard questions. I want to see this movie again. I don't think this is a single movie or single view movie. Like, there's so much to this thing. So I want to watch it a couple more times. But right now, I adore The Shining. I've seen it a million times. But I would say, I don't think I can put them completely in order, but I would put The Shining on the same level as this film, and then Eyes Wide Shut behind it.
Right.
For sure.
I think I need to see more. There's plenty more for me
different.
To see. They're very different. They have similarities. Every Kubrick movie has, like, the technique is the thing that binds them all, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're all very, like, very, like, the visuals are very defined, like, very, like, the framing, everything is so defined. You know you're watching a Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yeah.
That kind of connects them all. It's really, it's hard to pick. 2001 is such a, like, I adore this movie so much.
Well, it's like a cinematic achievement.
Yeah.
Whereas, I don't know if I would call The Shining that.
Right.
I mean, it is, and it's all right.
There
were
other great horror movies.
Yeah.
Like, Shining is one of the defining horror movies.
But this is like one of a kind.
2001 A Space Odyssey was like, nothing had been made like it. And to this day, I think people would argue, I mean, even Star Wars, which is amazing, and, you know, I think the difference between whether you're a film snob or whatever, you can be defined in, like, which do you prefer, Star Wars or 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Right.
But I think that's an unfair argument.
It's hard to stack these.
Someone who argues, like, oh, I think 2001's a better movie, I'm like, I'm not inclined to disagree with you. I prefer Star Wars, but they're two completely different kinds of movies, only connected by the fact that they're space movies.
Right.
And Star Wars is basically the anti-2001. It's all about motion and fast-paced
and
excitement and fantasy and fun and character. And 2001 is more the grandeur and the unknown and the mystery and the visuals.
You kind of end this movie and you're like, what is life?
Yeah, who
like,
am I? Yeah,
who am I?
Yeah.
Why am I here? I'm just a speck
of
dust.
Star Wars does not leave you asking questions.
No.
No, you're kind of like, that's exactly what I wanted. It's perfect.
I mean, I'll just say this was excellent, and I'm really looking forward to watching it
watching the sequel.
Again. 2010. Yes, obviously. 2010. We make here contact. We go.
Yes. So on a scale of 1 to 5 star childs, children?
Star children.
Star children. How many would you give it?
5. Yeah. 5. This movie deserves all 5
of these
star babies.
Me too. I'm amazed watching it. I don't think this movie, if it doesn't feel dated now, I don't think it'll ever feel dated.
No.
There are great movies that I adore that feel dated.
I want to call up my parents and ask them if they've seen this movie.
I'm sure.
They probably have.
Yeah.
You know. But
I feel like this is one of those movies you
and then I'm gonna yell
go
at them and be like, why did you show this
I'm
to
so
me?
I'm so upset we missed. They'd screened it in IMAX.
I know.
That would have been great to see.
Yeah.
But yeah, I adore I think it's perfect.
10
it's
more years, those, maybe.
Yeah,
we'll see it.
60th anniversary.
Yeah.
But I think this movie is one of those fine examples.
Yeah.
Put in a capsule and say, this is what movies are capable of. Love it.
It was great.
I was glad to revisit. But I guess that's that. And what I guess, you know, we're here on the Nerd Party, as we've already mentioned, thenerdparty.com. So much great stuff. You can follow us at Join Nerd Party on Twitter, like the Facebook page. It's just the Nerd Party. I'm also on Twitter at Yay Sean Doorman. Sarah, where can people find you?
I'm with Love Alone on Twitter and Instagram.
Great. And I think you should rate us if you haven't already on iTunes. It helps us a lot. The more happy ratings we get, the more people will see us. And that's what we want. And we love that. And we love you. Thanks so much for listening.